Welcome back to Caracast, the podcast from Carasoft, the trusted government IT solutions provider. Subscribe to get the latest technology updates in the public sector. I'm Anthony Jimenez, your host from the Carasoft production team. On behalf of PCMatic, we would like to welcome you to today's podcast, focused around how agencies can simplify endpoint protection and meet compliance requirements with PCMatic's automated allow listing solution. Adam Austin, owner of Totem Technologies, Corey Munson, vice president of PCMatic, and Willie Crenshaw, CEO of Cyberprime, will discuss application allow listing.
I'm excited to have the opportunity to bring these two thought leaders to the discussion today. Willie's a longtime friend of PCMatic, and full disclosure, also consults with us, but has a long, illustrious career in the federal government. And Adam has grown to be a friend of me personally and PCMatic over the years as we've discussed application allow listing and the various needs of allow listing across CMMC standards and otherwise. So it's exciting to be able to sit down and have a conversation with these two folks and talk a little bit about what is generally regarded as one of the most powerful but misunderstood tools in cybersecurity, that being allow listing, and how it relates to CMMC and some of the other cybersecurity standards and frameworks that are out there. I think what we wanted to do today, considering that the audience is really a cross-section of people that may be very familiar with CMMC, some folks that may not be familiar with it, some folks that may already know a lot about allow listing, some may not, is to cover the basics, but also to dive in into some detail and talk about maybe even some real world experience with trying to deploy solutions like allow listing as you work towards CMMC compliance. That being said, again, Willie and Adam, thank you so much for joining us. Let's start here. Let's kind of cut to it at the source of what we're talking about here. And if you haven't had a chance to read Adam's great blog post about what the heck is application allow listing in CMMC, that blog post will kind of serve as the guide of what we're going to cover here today. And at the core of his post, he talks about CUI and the need to be able to protect CUI and how urgent that is for federal contractors, especially those that happen to be small businesses that are having challenges with that. So Willie, from a federal perspective, you've come up against CUI. Explain to us what that is and why it's such a big deal in the federal space, if you don't mind.
Thanks a lot, Corey, and welcome to everybody here. Controlled unclassified information. I think a lot of people, even when dealing with DOD's from its perspective and mission, is usually in the secret realm. So it's usually classified information that you're dealing with when you're dealing with DOD. But also on the civilian side of the house, there are some documentation and there's information that is what we call controlled unclassified information. It's not classified. It's still a high classification, and it needs to be protected, and it needs all of the controls and all of the policies and all of the care, because if it gets out, it can cause irreparable harm. So it's not at the level of it needs to be compartmentalized like secret or top secret or anything like that, but it is a higher level of classification within the federal workspace that data needs to be protected. People tend to think and say, oh, unclassified, then we can do anything with it. No, that's not the case. That's why it came out under the Obama administration with the executive orders that controlled unclassified information. It's kind of renamed back then, and it came out so that we can make sure that we're safeguarding and we're protecting that data at a higher level than we would say anything that's just unclassified or is not controlled. So there are those elements within an organization that is not a secret organization or deal with secret information or nation states and things like that that needs to be controlled and protected. So that's what I would say the main thing in the federal government is making sure that you're controlling that information and making sure you're keeping it safe, because if it did get out, it could cause irreparable harm to the organization or the American public.
So, Adam, is it fair to say that CUI is a higher priority than it used to be, or has it always been a priority and now there's just some guidelines for compliance and regulation?
Yeah, it's always been a priority, and nice to be chatting with you, Corey and Willie, and thanks for the opportunity. It's been a priority since, as Willie mentioned, the Obama administration. Well, even before that, it was controlled unclassified information was known by a couple different monikers, sensitive but unclassified, and a couple other things. You might heard the FOUO for official use only, and there was a lot of inconsistency in labeling the unclassified but still sensitive information that was handled on federal government programs. Those markings and the labeling, the handling was consolidated under the Obama administration, and that executive order that Willie mentioned actually identified the National Archives and Records Administration as the oversight office for this federal government CUI program. And then it was up to each individual agency to adopt the National Archives policies and promulgate them or distribute them or flow them down through their supply chains. Because what's key here is that the federal government's employees and workforce handle CUI. It's information, I like to say it's information of a technical or mission-related nature associated with the agency's mission or technologies that the agency uses and procures. But it's not just federal government employees that handle it. It is, in large part, the supply chain for those federal government agencies. And so there has to be this what we call flow-down process where the agency directs the members of its supply chain to protect this sensitive but unclassified information, this controlled information. And that's been going on in various forms amongst the federal agencies since 2010. The DOD in particular equipped itself with a contractual clause that obligates its supply chain to protect CUI if it encounters it. And that clause has been around for almost a decade, if not more. We've had these contractual obligations for a decade plus years as members of the supply chain. And our parent company actually is a DOD prime contractor. The increased emphasis on the protection, if you will, is in large part, it stems from the DOD's rolling out this accountability model, the Cybersecurity Maturity Certification Model, CMMC. And where there'll be serious repercussions from a contractual standpoint and maybe even civil and criminal liability standpoint for not adequately protecting this information. So the DOD is sort of the tip of the spear, but something like these, some sort of accountability model will be adopted eventually by all of the federal executive branch agencies for sure. So the reason that we're talking more about CUI is because of this DOD program that's being rolled out.
But fair to say that you see this moving across all federal agencies. Is that your view as well, Willie? This is just the starting point.
I'm glad Adam brought that up because, you know, one of my roles was the Governance Risk and Compliance Executive over at NASA in implementing the CDM program, the Continuous Diagnostics and Mitigation Program, on the civilian side. And what stemmed from that was discussions along with DOD to say, okay, how can we kind of level set the government from a cybersecurity perspective across not just the civilian sector, but also DOD? And CMMC kind of was born out of that. The idea of CMMC kind of hook on to the CDM concept. And now you've got both of them kind of working together. DHS at one point, I don't know if you remember Kevin Cox and now Katie Arrington, who's the acting CIO over at DOD, got together and started talking about how can these two things, how, you know, because we learned and we kind of knew it, but then there were other connections between DOD and the intelligence community and the civilian community. So the civilians were community was seen as a weak link, so to speak, because, you know, easy for target for nation states and stuff like that. You kind of had that discussion and revelation from both sides of the house to say, how can we protect federal data across both, even if it crosses over from DOD? Because DOD has a unclassified section to it, right? It does have a lot of secret and classified things, but it also has an unclassified spot. And I know like at NASA, where you have the rockets and things, that's unclassified on that side of the house. But then you have the military's arm that's doing similar stuff. So how can we keep that stuff protected? So I see it as kind of a thing on the civilian side as well as DOD as something that's needed. And actually, a lot of the stuff that's in CMMC has been the things that we've been trying to do on the civilian side to protect that data because it was a weak link. You know, it's hard to break in. Remember in the 90s, I was at the Pentagon. The Pentagon was getting slammed all the time on people trying to break into the Pentagon network, which was hard to do because it was segregated, you know, separately. And so the attack vector changed to where now the state actors and the hackers were saying, well, you know what? We learned we can get to DOD from this other agency that isn't as protected. So we had to put those controls in place. And, you know, this is prior to NIST. I told you I'm aging myself. This is kind of prior to NIST and stuff like that before those controls were put in place. And then we learned that, yes, we do have very, very sensitive data that can lead someone to see what is over on the DOD side. So you can see the two worlds were coming together. And once that was discovered, they were able to find out, it says, like Adam said, the supply chain and the connection between the civilian world and the DOD world. And, you know, the intelligence community is a little bit different because they just kind of operate autonomously almost.
Yeah, they do.
But yeah, you don't mess with them. But the DOD piece of it is a little bit more connected because the war fighter and the civilian and all those types of things. So I think what you're getting into now with CMMC is the requirement on the DOD side that mirrors almost some of the stuff that we've been doing with CDM and trying to do with CDM to bring the entire government up to a certain security level.
And I might add, Corey, please. I mentioned that CUI, so just to add on what Willie's talking about there's interrelationships between these federal executive branch agencies. And I mentioned that NARA is the National Archives has the oversight for the program. They actually have the responsibility to categorize types of information that would constitute controlled unclassified information. There's over 124 different categories, and it's not just NASA, the DOD, Department of Education, student financial records, when handled by the federal government or its contractors, are considered CUI. And just to go back to your initial point, Corey, that and Willie's points, that our adversaries are actively trying to steal both technological information. There's dozens of examples of both commercial and military technology that have been stolen by our adversaries. But not just technological information. They're interested in the mission. All large state governments have a bureaucracy and an infrastructure that they need to maintain. And if they don't have to reinvent the wheel or invent it themselves, if they could steal information about how the U.S. does it efficiently, they're interested in stealing that information as well. So the CUI is pervasive. It's ubiquitous across the entire federal executive branches, agencies, and all the supply chains as well.
Which serves as a good segue point here, Adam. Now that we understand what's at stake, let's talk about at least this framework that's attempting to get a handle on this in the shape of CMMC. Adam, can you walk us through at a kind of a high level what CMMC is, and then we can drill down from there?
So we mentioned that the DOD is the first of the executive branch agencies to formally hold its supply chain accountable for protecting controlled unclassified information that really we're privileged to handle by the virtue of executing a federal contract, whether you're a prime tier one contractor, tier two sub, or supplier and vendor. If you're working on technology or the mission for the DOD, then you're handling CUI. The CMMC is just the accountability model. It is the model the DOD has set up for itself to verify that we're doing our job to protect the sensitive information, that we are meeting our contractual obligations. There's three levels to this model. All of the Department of Defense supply chain, what's called the DIB, Defense Industrial Base, will be subject to level one, at least. We all handle what's called federal contract information, FCI. Those of us that handle the more sensitive subset of FCI, CUI, are going to be subject to level two or level three. And it's at that level that we have a standard that was published by NIST, as Willie mentioned, National Institutes of Standards and Technology. We have a standard to implement, a standard, a list, if you will, a checklist of cybersecurity safeguards to implement on our private sector IT systems to protect this CUI. The NIST publication is called 800-171. There have been three revisions to this standard over the years. And CMMC, for the time being, is coupled to Revision 2, but Revision 3 has been published by NIST. Actually, last year it was published, and eventually the DoD will require us to transition from Rev 2 to Rev 3 of the 800-171 standard. There's also this third level of CMMC, which is associated with what I call CUI Plus, which is everything that we've learned from the DoD. They haven't explicitly defined what CUI Plus is, but it sounds like it's information related to critical weapons programs like hypersonic missiles, the nuclear arsenal upgrade, missile defense systems, sixth generation fighters and bombers. So these requirements have, the requirement to protect CUI has been around a long time, 15 years or so. This model, which is almost ready to be fully rolled out by the DoD in the next couple of months, this is the accountability model. And if you don't, if your organization doesn't appropriately or effectively implement these standards, then individuals at the organization under this model can be held civilly and maybe even criminally liable. So it's got teeth to it. It's the first agency that has a has an accountability model with real teeth to it.
Adam, you kind of, I think you alluded to the fact that we're maybe months away from this taking hold, but where are we time? It seems like there's been talk about CMMC for years and years and years, but we're nearing the finish line about this thing being reality, right?
Yeah, so there's two parts to the CMMC model. The first part was establishing the framework, which is sort of depicted on that last slide, and that's been in the works and been finalized for half a year or so. The second part of the model is the what gives the DoD the ability to hold us, mandate the adoption of the framework, if you will. So the DoD has to equip itself with a new contracts clause, essentially. And that work is almost finished. In fact, it is in the final stages of review with the White House right now, and it should be published imminently in the next month or two. And then there's a 60-day sort of adoption or waiting period, and then the DoD will have the ability to require us to adopt that model, require us to hold ourselves and have third parties hold us accountable for the appropriate protection of CUI. So it's coming. It'll be a phased-in approach over time, as you see from this chart here. But within, certainly by the end of this calendar year, we will start seeing these requirements in new contracts.
Adam talked about it, Willie, in how the CMMC standards tie to the NIST framework. Can you talk a little bit, and you kind of started to mention it earlier on about maybe some of your experience with federal agencies attempting to use NIST controls, but talk about how you saw the NIST controls maybe at the endpoint level implemented, but really maybe hadn't been audited necessarily. Talk a little bit about your experience there, where this is putting a little more teeth into it, but this has been the guideline all along, is to follow NIST as close as possible, right?
Yeah, and I think people need to understand that NIST is a guide, right? It's standards of in a guide. So a lot of folks would just regurgitate what's in NIST and think that they've met the control. My experience is making sure that when you say access AC control, which is access control, right? Who has access to the system? How are you going to handle that? How are you handling that? How people get their privileges, those types of things, and what roles they actually have. You know, when you look at NIST and the assessments of it, a lot of people get scared about assessment. And one thing, you know, I was working with Ron Ross on a lot of this stuff of the 800 series back in the day when it was first being rolled out. The initial thought was, and what we're trying to get people to do, was to assess as the system matures, right? Not just wait till it used to be you hear the horror stories of the huge binder sitting on the shelf for 3 years and then nobody pulls it out for another 3 years and then companies have to pay, or the government would have to pay a boatload of money to go through that whole assessment catalog. People didn't understand how to use the catalog. They didn't understand how to do what we call control tailoring. And that is selecting a group of controls that are specific to your system. And I think for this audience here, when you start looking at CMMC and the requirements from DoD, use some of those strategies of control tailoring. What controls do I really need to address based on the system that we're developing or what we're involved in? And so once you do that, what we call control tailoring, then you can then, when you get to the assessment piece of it, you're not having to assess, say, 400 or 300 or how many of the controls is in 171 that you have to meet. You're only, say, meeting maybe even half of those or maybe in a subset of those. And then do the assessment not all at once, but do it over the span of the 3 years. We used to say a third, and a third, right? You probably heard that over time of taking a third of controls and assessing those every year, because really the requirement is that as long as all your controls are assessed, all of the things are addressed within a 3 year period, that system can continue and continuous certification, and it spans out the cost of maintaining your security and updating your security across the board, unless you have some major changes that you're implementing in place. So that has been the real crux of the matter and how it's been applied. It's how you apply it. It's not necessarily, don't get scared of the catalog. Don't get scared of all the stuff that that DoD may be requiring you to do. It's just taking the time to really build out the plan at inception, at the beginning, go through with the engineers and stuff like that and say, here are the controls we know we're going to have and we need to address. And here's at what level we need to address them, and then write those into your whole plan and then maintain that throughout the life cycle of the system. Unless it has a major change, then yes, you have to start back over at the beginning. Now, DoD has been doing this for a long time. The government used to do this, and now what they're doing is that they're actually putting that on the contractor for requirements, because the government, for one, sees it as a way of making sure that contractors are meeting the same level of rigor and same security as is required by the federal government, so that they don't get hacked in their company. I think the misconception too, and Adam, you can ring in here as well, is that, hey, my whole company doesn't have to do it. It's just a subset or section. The government really wants the whole company to be behind you and doing all of these things, making sure that everyone is trained in security, making sure everyone is checked, making sure all those roles are up to date and made available and secure, rather than just a subset of that that's just working on federal data. They really want your company to be secure in the back end.
Yeah, they want you to build a cybersecurity culture and not just treat cybersecurity as an IT problem. Yeah, I totally agree. The difference with the CMMC is that there will be these point-in-time assessments for members of the supply chain. It's not on the federal government side. We do that every year, a third of the controls. Now we're going to have all of our controls assessed during a single assessment at least once every 3 years by an independent party. I'm sorry. And Willie, I really liked what you mentioned about showing that part of the continuous diagnosis and monitoring was to show that you can control configuration and change securely and mature securely over time. And I just wanted to say, I really appreciate what your office put out at NASA. We actually used the NASA's nice configuration management plan template.
Right.
We got rid of the federal government specific talk, but we sort of genericized that and use it as one of our policy templates.
Oh, nice. So I wrote that.
That is, love it. Mm-hmm. So configuration management is my favorite family of controls. It's been drilled into me from the beginning of my career that it is the most important aspect of cybersecurity, and allow listing is under the configuration management family or domain of controls in the 800-171, the NIST library of controls, and those that have been tailored for the controlled unclassified information, the 800-171 standard. So,
yeah, and I think that has been neglected. A lot of the allow listing, we used to call it application whitelisting, all that type of stuff has been neglected, mainly, and Corey, you've heard me say this before, mainly because of the governance, the governance piece of it. People want to figure out how the governance is done prior to implementing allow listing, but not understanding that now we're at a critical point where we need allow listing. It is something that even in CDM, We kind of put to the side and got everything else in until we could figure out or try to figure out what that is. So to your point, Adam, configuration management is key, because if a system is misconfigured or is not configured correctly or doesn't change with upgrades and patches and other things like that, then that's where we're finding out that we kind of really get hit the worst. You know, people are pretty good at keeping their credentials. People are pretty good at other things. But when it comes to configuration of a system or the lack thereof, then that's where you get a lot of those issues. So glad to hear that document was very useful for you.
Oh, very much so. You'll find it for the genericized version of it available for download from our free tools. So we made it small business friendly. And
cool. I got to check that out.
Very much appreciate it. Not just maintaining a configuration and knowing what you have, but being able to change the configuration securely, because, you know, life is all about change. So is an IT system. New technologies come aboard where it's especially fraught right now with all the AI technologies. Being able to change securely is a key, maybe the key component of configuration management.
Maybe to step back for a second, and you get segued into the allow listing piece here perfectly. I appreciate that. But for those who aren't familiar with what allow listing is, or maybe familiar with it as under a different name, Adam, in your blog post, you had the perfect analogy, I think, to TSA. Can you take a spin through that one quick about what we're actually talking about here with allow listing as a control?
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember when you didn't need a ticket to get to the gate at an airport. Mm-hmm. In the blog, I sort of relate a story, but that story was actually associated with me. I had my brother and his best friend come with me to the gate at the airport. I was afraid to fly way back in the day, late 90s. And we had drinks in a bar, and they weren't going. It was me flying. It was just me. So at the airport, you used to be able to do that. But those days are long gone. And the analogy that we set up in the blog with the TSA is that you can't get past security, much less to a gate, without being on some pre-approved list. So you have to have a ticket in hand, and you have to have identification and be on the list that they're looking for, that they are comparing against, right? So there's this pre-approved list of allowed passengers past security. And that's the analogy that we use in the blog. And it's a very similar, it's an analogy, right? So it's similar to what's going on with allow listing in terms of applications and software in an IT system.
It really flips the paradigm of endpoint protection as we've historically known it, right? Most antivirus products have been built around the idea that you're going to be able to keep track of all the known viruses out there in the planet, push those signatures out to a system and block anything that happens to come up on a system based on that list, which now we know that's impractical. It's every 30 some seconds, something's morphing into something new. So the need for a more, like you're saying, default deny approach, or actually it's spelled out as default deny allow listing, It's never been more critical. And I think that's one of the reasons it's baked into the NIST framework, which is directly tied to the CMMC standards and compliance that folks are trying to achieve. And that's one of the things your organization, Adam, is doing, is helping folks understand exactly how they're going to be able to potentially check some of these boxes like application allow listing.
I think too, Corey, to Adam's point, I'm old enough, and Adam, you may be, and Corey, you guys may be old enough to remember Novell, right? In the old Novell operating system, network operating system back in the day, that model was very secure in a lot of ways, because Novell was built around the core operating system, and in modules, you had to hook modules to it. So you had to get certain permissions before you actually allowed anything else to hook to the operating system in and of itself. So allow listing is that thing that we're talking about, and we're moving on the civilian side of the house, as well as DOD has been doing it, right? Is the zero trust, you know, trust no one and allow by exception. And so how do you do that with software? How do you do that with all types of other things as well, to where, you know, we're of the age of Microsoft where, you know, just let's install it, let's download the app and install it, and we don't think about security. But that's a dangerous thing when you start talking about the federal and you start talking about corporate, because There's a lot of stuff out there. And the problem has always been is how do we determine who built what, where, and whether or not it's malicious? Because like you said, Corey, the antivirus stuff is, you know, that was child's play. You know, the virus shuts you down, you reboot it, you reformat your drive and reinstall all your operating systems, you're back up and running again. Now in today's world, you never know when you're going to have a zero day. You don't know if you're going to have a Trojan horse or whatever it may be. And that kicks off without you even knowing it. So being able to deny something that I don't know what it is, because, you know, our kids download stuff at home and stuff like that. But then also now remote working. COVID brought in a spike in remote work where people are working on their own home networks. So, you know, we're losing our minds here on the cyber side in the Fed of what's at your home, because we can't control your home network that you're hooking a government furnished equipment to really find out, are we really being protected? And unless we have those layers of security, it becomes a more and more dangerous as we kind of open up to the internet. I've always said this in my career is that the only way you can secure anything is disconnect from the internet completely and just have it be standalone. Even at that, you have something called insider threat. So I just wanted to kind of point that out as well as some of the things that people need to take into account is that we don't have this, the attack vector has changed. And then you talk about AI, Adam, you brought in AI was tremendous because that's a whole nother beast in and of itself of how we're going to protect these systems now with AI making a push. How do you protect that stuff? How do you protect CUI when AI is doing a lot of different things? So trying to build AI around security is going to be tough. So you definitely need something like CMMC, allow listing, and all the rest of that stuff that's got to help you out with the layered security.
Yeah, you're required to. There's literally a control in the 800.171 standard, a safeguard that requires you to control the flow of CUI. And now it's a race with all these vendors, Microsoft, Adobe, you name it, to integrate these AI features into their software. And every day, almost literally every day, there's some new executable that's AI related that allow listing is blocking because we're in a deny by default, but that I have no idea what the purpose of this feature or this tool is, nor do I know where my information is going if it happens to be harvested or utilized by this tool. But I'm required to control the flow. So it is, like I said, it's fraught. It's very tricky. Waters out here right now with the AI stuff.
Adam, can you step us back to draw the line from the requirement to allow listing to the various CMMC levels? So is allow listing required in 1, 2, 3? Is it, where does that stand?
It's required for the protection of CUI, which is associated with level 2 and level 3 in the CMMC assessment model. It is a great idea. And in fact, we argue it's one of the two best cybersecurity technologies or cybersecurity safeguards in existence. So it would be strongly suggested to implement allow listing, even if you're not handling CUI, you're just handling federal contract information, which is what's associated with level 1 in CMMC. Or for that matter, even if you're not in handling federal government information, you have intellectual property at your business, you might be handling personally identifiable information. From your staff and healthcare information and pension information, that sort of thing. It's a great idea to put the best protections in place to protect any kind of sensitive information.
Willie, you kind of touched on this earlier. Yeah. Allow listing itself, not necessarily a new concept. It's been around forever. I mean, if you wanted to manually go in and try to configure it on your own, it was possible, but it was a pretty heavy lift. So historically, what is that the problem? Is that why more people haven't relied on this as a strategy? Because it was difficult to manage, difficult to deploy. What's your take on that?
The deployment, you know, there have been other products that the deployment wasn't the hard part. The hard part, again, is the governance of it, right? The onboarding, offboarding of software, who's going to do that? And then when you say, well, yeah, we can tackle onboarding, we can put a process in place on how we're going to allow software to enter our environment. Okay, but how do you know that that software is authentic? How do you know that that's good stuff? And that became, you know, one of the things we did at NASA, we found out, was that we got to that point to where we had the tool, we had a tool that we wanted to put in place. We started to implement it. Then we got to a place of saying, you know what, we are so diverse within the environment with different things, with scientists and rockets and all this other kind of stuff. We need to be able to give people the flexibility to do their job. But also, we had so many different types of software, but we had no way of really understanding where all this stuff was coming from. And then, you know, as you said, Adam, enter into moving more to the cloud and more apps being downloaded. So it was almost like we needed a information store or Apple store for software that has been vetted. And we found out that there wasn't that vetting that was needed to say, you know what? Yes, I like this product. I like product X, Y, and Z, but I don't know where it came from. Did it come from China? Did it come from Korea? Did it come from somewhere else? Who put it out there? It's great stuff, but should we be using this in our environment? So it's tough to really look and see without a proper allow listing product. Oh, something that has done the work in an automated fashion, and it becomes a resource drain, right? You know, you can't hire your way out of multiple people to look up products and see where they come from. And then at that, there's a stopping point, even with the federal government, even with places like the FBI and intelligence community, there's certain data they won't share or can't share.
And thanks for that, Willie, which kind of brings me to, you know, at the heart of what we do here at PCmatic, it's our lifeblood is allow listing. And we've got a couple of different flavors of allow listing that we enable people to be able to take advantage of. And I know, Adam, you've been able to dabble with a few of them, one of which happens to be our global approach, which we make a determination and our malware research team makes determinations on what belongs on a global allow list. And customers can use that as a jumping off point, you know, immediately upon deployment without having to build their own allow list. So that's one approach. But I know, Adam, you've played with the other side of that, is just simply using our platform for building your own local allow list and setting different restrictions based on what you've decided should run inside of a particular environment. So you've seen both sides of it.
I have, yeah. And appreciate both sides. And if you think about, we're saying allow list, right? So it's allow by exception, but deny by default. And with your global, the PCmatic global allow list, you have a team of professionals that are adding to the allow list exceptions one by one. The rest of the stuff is denied. Everything that's not on that allow list is denied. If we go back to the TSA analogy, there's a lot of infrastructure behind this, the airport gating process and security process, right? And Willie, to your point, the implementation is, it doesn't have to be hard, but for small businesses, it can be a serious challenge because of that, the sort of the legwork that has to go into creating the allow list in the first place, creating that configuration management or governance process. Most small businesses don't have that process. So what I really like about the PCmatic approach is that it takes part of that sort of the initial upfront legwork burden off of the implementer, off of the adopter of the technology. And then on top of that, as an organization get more mature in your allow listing process, you can create your own local allow lists for software that might not necessarily be on the global list that you need to run or that you need to block, for that matter, that you need to explicitly deny, and manage that internally. And it makes, so this sort of approach makes it much more adoptable by what we're focused on, small businesses. So we're a small business, we focus on our clients, our peer small businesses. So it's a really lovely approach and much more easy to adopt, or much easier to adopt for a small business than, and I don't want to throw Microsoft under the bus, but if you Google the Microsoft blogs on what's called WDAC, Windows Defender Application Control, every single one of those blogs has you running some kind of PowerShell script. And most small businesses, and a lot of our managed service providers don't have like the administrative horsepower or the resources, for that matter, just the time to go through and work all that stuff and put all the scripts together and roll out these allow listing packages. So the concept of a global allow list, where there's a team of professionals that are actively curating a list of allowed stuff and sort of getting us over that first hurdle so that we can actually start our implementation. As Willie mentioned it at the beginning, the main problem with allow listing is that we just are too afraid to start, or we don't know where to start, or we don't know how to do it. We don't have the resources to do the governance, the upfront legwork. So it's a really nice approach.
And you know what, Adam, that's true even in larger organizations. That's the federal government's issue, right? It's not, I know people think the federal government has long money, but actually the budgets aren't there, right? So and just because of the way Congress does budgeting. So but even if you have the funding, you know, you're talking about the larger the organization, the more resources you're going to need, like you're saying, to build that global list. So one of the things that was very intriguing to me when I heard about PCmatic was the fact that that's what really got me interested, was that global allow list and how they were doing it. And because being, you know, I headed up the supply chain risk management group at NASA as well. And we were pushed into it by law. But at the end of the day, one of the things that we ran into, the problems we ran into, continued to be, could we get good data on the products that we were allowing in the environment? And that was tough even on the hardware front, and really, really tough on the software front, because you know what? Hardware you can track, right? You can track it through, you know, where it's coming from, whose port is entering, things like that. Software is way different. Somebody could put their name on it, digital signatures, those types of things. And if you don't have the expertise to look into that and look into code, then you're just kind of really kind of taking a shot in the dark. So that was one of the things that really attracted me about PCmatic at the onset, was the fact that they had this global malware team that actually put eyeballs on the code and then were able to say, hey, Willie, here's what we found out there that's good. Here's what we found out there that's bad. And that at least gave me a starting point to say, you know what? Here's how the governance can start out. And this is how that's a big, big, big push that helps a small organization and a large, medium-sized and large organizations as well.
Willie, do you have a supply chain risk management plan template that I can download?
Contact me. I got you covered. All
right. There you go. So, Adam, you mentioned that you deal with a lot of smaller businesses that are trying to address some of these challenges and figure out the best path forward. And one of the best things I've seen you produce, while we're talking about good content that each of you are producing, you've got the PC hardening guide for even a single PC that you guys published. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I thought that was a really strong, actionable piece of content that's out there.
Yeah, we have a lot of organizations, very micro organizations, one or two person organizations, come to us looking for help because they're vastly underserved sort of niche in federal government contracting. And they can't afford necessarily, they're trying to break into federal government contracting, they have a really good idea, or they have a very small contract, but that doesn't give them the resources to pay the monthly fees to a managed service provider, outsourcing IT, in other words. So we were looking for a way to help them out, at least get them started. So we published a single PC hardening guide. It's a lay person's term explanation of all the technological things that company has to do to meet the 800-171 standard, and a sequenced task list of how to take an out-of-the-box Windows PC, Windows 11 PC, and harden it up, put the technologies and sort of, figuratively speaking, tweak the knobs and flip the switches under the hood of the Windows operating system to get it to the point where it's hardened enough to pass muster under the 800-171 standard. And as this chart here shows, white allow listing is required under the standard, at least in Rev 3, what will be required to adopt in short order. And in Rev 2, you get a choice between allow listing and deny listing, but allow listing is a more powerful and easier to manage in the long run, for that matter. So one of the tasks is apply an allow listing package onto this PC. What we really like about PC-Matic is that it really facilitates the execution of that task for a one- or two-person organization. And the PC hardening guide is meant for those mom-and-pop shops that are underserved by the MSP community. And if they're willing to put a little bit of elbow grease into it, willing to do some Google Foo, watch some YouTube videos, they can execute that PC hardening guide, including implementing allow listing.
Thanks for listening, and thank you to our guests, Adam Austin, Corey Munson, and Willie Crenshaw. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe to Caracast, and be sure to listen to our other discussions. If you'd like more information on how PC-Matic can assist your organization, please visit www.carasoft.com or email us at pcmaticmarketing@carasoft.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a great day.